Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Tuesday, July 21st, 2026, for our Commodities and Energy edition.
Today, we are examining the intensifying collision between digital acceleration and physical infrastructure. The unprecedented surge in computational demand is fundamentally rewriting the long-held assumptions regarding baseline electricity requirements for the global economy.
It is no longer just about data, it is about the sheer wattage required to run it.
And that tension is most visible within the emerging AI power hunger, where the scaling of large-scale model training is creating immediate structural pressures on aging grid architectures.
PJM is reporting that supply costs have already surged by over 60% because of data center demand, which is a pretty polite way of saying the AI boom is essentially a massive, uninvited guest at the dinner party that's eating all the food and refusing to pay the bill.
It's more than just an expensive guest, Maya. We're looking at a fundamental reshaping of the global commodities and energy landscape. We're moving toward a reality where the AI revolution is actually an energy revolution, because the sheer volume of computational demand is projected to outrun the 1-2% annual efficiency gains that have historically kept rising power demand hidden.
So all those clever little software tweaks designed to save electricity are basically being rendered useless by the sheer brute force of more chips.
The data tells a story. The scale is staggering. We're seeing AI capital expenditures projected at $1 trillion, which, when you consider total global corporate capex is around $4 trillion, means AI represents roughly 2-5% of all corporate investment, but it's cannibalizing the rest. In the US, that $1 trillion infrastructure push is effectively matching the entire annual budget of the Department of Defense.
So we're essentially building a digital military-industrial complex. But instead of tanks, we're just stacking more GPUs and hoping they don't melt the local power grid.
And that's where the physical reality hits the balance sheet. As Bloomberg Surveillance noted, the future of big tech now depends on a trifecta of compute intelligence, and most critically, energy availability. We are seeing the emergence of energy parks. Data centers are no longer just buildings with servers. They are evolving into complex, multi-layered energy ecosystems. Because advanced semiconductors require such precise power quality, you see a hierarchy of storage ranging from ultracapacitors directly on the chip to massive battery arrays at the perimeter of the facility.
I love the term energy parks. It sounds so much more pastoral than massive heat-spewing monoliths that make your electricity bill spike.
But the spike is real. In New York, Governor Kathy Hochul has already implemented a one-year moratorium on data centers requiring at least 50 megawatts. The logic is a strategic regulatory pause to prevent flooding the zone with energy surges that could compromise residential grid stability. New York is effectively choosing to prioritize high-density job creators, like the $100 billion Micron investment, over largely vacant data centers that consume massive amounts of power without proportional employment gains.
It's the classic NIMBY argument, just upgraded for the Silicon Age. Not in my backyard, because I actually want to be able to run my air conditioner in July.
And that sentiment is spreading. We're seeing significant political resistance driven by rising electricity costs and the impact on essential utilities like water. There is even a coordinated three-vector campaign of foreign influence targeting U.S. development. As Sam Lyman highlighted, there's a movement leveraging China state media, the Singham network of U.S.-based nonprofits, and foreign billionaire philanthropy to promote anti-data center and anti-export control policies. Specifically, lobbying from groups like the Oak Foundation and the efforts of Swiss billionaire Hans-Jürg Wyss are using dark money to push environmental policies that specifically aim to impede U.S. data center expansion.
So it's not just local residents complaining about the noise. It's a sophisticated, well-funded effort to regulate the U.S. out of the AI race.
It's a strategic attempt to influence the regulatory landscape. But there is a massive industrial convergence happening simultaneously that might provide a workaround. We're seeing an emerging intersection between Bitcoin mining and high-performance computing, or HPC. As noted in Macro Musings with David Beckecht, the massive energy requirements of Bitcoin mining are driving miners to pivot their infrastructure toward AI. They already have the high-capacity power connections and the cooling-intensive setups.
So the crypto miners are essentially the infrastructure-as-a-service providers for the AI era?
In a way, yes. We're even seeing companies like Meta potentially shifting their strategy. Rather than just being a consumer AI player, Meta could become a secondary infrastructure provider, leasing excess computing power from their massive 8-14 gigawatt capacity to subsidize their own massive capex during periods when their product development hits a lull.
It's a clever way to squeeze every cent of utility out of those chips. But what happens when the energy supply actually hits a wall? I mean, the grid isn't exactly known for its flexibility.
That's the systemic risk. We're facing a data visibility gap where we lack real-time information on electron flows, making it incredibly hard to integrate distributed resources like vehicle-to-grid technology. And the stakes are incredibly high. As we discuss on this podcast, a Carrington-level solar event could trigger a permanent collapse of the North American power grid because the failure of 55,000 essential substations would destroy custom-made multi-million-dollar transformers that are not off-the-shelf products. They require years of specialized manufacturing to replace. And the global recovery capacity is crippled by a single point of failure, our reliance on Swiss manufacturing for these essential transformers.
We're essentially one bad solar flare away from a permanent dark age because we can't replace our own plugs.
It's a massive bottleneck. This is why we're seeing a shift in where the real money is moving. As Gerard Reed and Rowan Parkhouse from Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners noted, the most lucrative future investment opportunities aren't in the data centers themselves, but in the underlying power solutions, flexible connections, and the infrastructure required to support the transition. We're seeing a surge in demand for alternative architectures. For instance, Bloom Energy's solid oxide fuel cell technology is benefiting from a supply chain-induced substitution effect, as a multi-year backlog in traditional gas turbines forces the energy sector to find new ways to meet AI-driven demand.
Although if Bloom Energy needs more scandium to hit their 25-gigawatt target, and China controls the scandium supply, we're back to the same old geopolitical chess game.
The pattern is clear, it's an interconnected web. Even the way we price electricity is changing. The rise of AI-driven data centers, which require 24/7 cooling, is fundamentally altering the nocturnal demand profile of the grid. They prevent the typical nighttime demand troughs, which leads to elevated overnight electricity prices, especially during heat waves.
So the machines never sleep, and neither does the price of power.
And the financial architecture is struggling to keep up. Credit agencies are now using scenario analysis to see if these high-growth companies can actually generate enough revenue to service the massive debt being used to fund this. We're seeing a shift toward highly complex, structured debt instruments designed specifically to ensure that future technology-driven revenues can catch up to and repay these escalating loads.
It's a massive, high-stakes bet on the idea that the intelligence we extract from these chips will eventually pay for the very expensive, very hungry infrastructure they live on.
It is.
And the risk of a high correlation accident is real. If AI exposure becomes too pervasive across leveraged ETFs, like the $20 billion SOXL, a single market shock could trigger a synchronized collapse across seemingly unrelated sectors.
Utilities and regulators need to decide if they are going to subsidize this expansion or cap it before the grid hits a breaking point.
We'll have to see if the next quarterly earnings from the major cloud providers show enough actual token utilization to justify the electricity bill.
But all of this infrastructure spend is clearly putting a massive strain on the broader cost of capital. We all entered 2026 expecting a smooth landing where inflation just evaporated into the ether. But instead, we're staring at a landscape where the Fed is playing a game of structural hide-and-seek, private credit is quietly becoming a retail phenomenon, and the very idea of an independent central bank feels like a vintage heirloom we're all just pretending is still functional.
It certainly feels more like a high-stakes game of musical chairs than a smooth landing. Especially when you look at how the plumbing of global liquidity is being rewired by everything from presidential removal powers to the shifting appetite of Japanese bondholders.
It's getting a bit ridiculous, isn't it? We've gone from worrying about simple interest rate tweaks to wondering if the Fed is actually a sovereign nation, then to worrying that your 401k is effectively subsidizing high-risk software loans, and finally to the very real possibility that the U.S. Treasury might just run out of people willing to buy the debt.
That last part isn't just hyperbole. Bloomberg Surveillance flagged a potential black swan risk in the treasury market specifically tied to the structural decline of Japanese foreign bidding, which leaves a massive question mark over how the U.S. will absorb its current mountain of debt and coupon obligations.
We have a massive debt overhang and a central bank that might be losing its legal armor. How does the Fed actually stay independent if the White House is essentially looking for any legal loophole to exert control?
It's an unstable equilibrium right now. As noted on Oddlots, the distinction between the Fed and more politically vulnerable agencies like the FTC is often more ideological than legal, relying on handshake agreements like the 1951 Treasury Accord rather than robust permanent law. There is a profound constitutional risk where a unitary executive could use non-recourse loans to acquire assets like Trump coins by accepting them as collateral, effectively bypassing traditional fiscal constraints and blurring the line between monetary and fiscal policy.
Wait, so you're telling me the Fed's independence is essentially just a polite social convention that could be ignored the moment a president decides they want to use the Fed's balance sheet as their personal stimulus package?
Two things stand out. Even the way the board maintains its autonomy is precarious. The board's independence is structurally tethered to its ability to bypass the congressional appropriations process by unilaterally raising assessments on Federal Reserve banks, which essentially allows it to function as an autonomous money printing machine that circumvents White House and OMB oversight. If the judiciary continues to expand presidential removal powers, that money printing machine could eventually be reclassified as a mere executive tool.
Which is great for the president, but terrifying for anyone trying to price a long-term commodity contract. If the Fed is just a megaphone for the White House, price stability becomes a very flexible concept.
And that's where the inflation math gets messy. We see a massive tension right now between Chair Kevin Warsh's cautious silence and the more vocal inflation concerns from officials like Chris Waller. While some, like Tiffany Wilding, predict U.S. headline inflation could drop below 2% next year, there's a massive supply-side risk. If we see spikes in energy costs or new tariff adjustments, that inflation isn't just transitory, it's structural.
And we can't exactly ignore the salient prices. You can tell the Fed that the core inflation numbers look fine, but the second someone pulls up to a gas pump and sees a massive year-over-year spike in gasoline, inflation expectations are going to unanchor instantly.
Worth noting, U.S. inflation expectations are incredibly sensitive to those salient prices. Even if the broader economy shows signs of slowing, as the recent ADP and NFP data suggest, a supply-side shock in energy or food, driven by something like tensions in the Strait of Hormuz, can force the Fed into a much more aggressive tightening cycle than the market is pricing in.
It's like trying to steer a ship during a hurricane using only a compass that someone is constantly shaking. And while the Fed is wobbling, the private credit market is busy doing its own thing, expanding into every corner of the retail market.
It's a massive shift in the capital stack. Because traditional institutional supply has been exhausted, major managers like Blackstone, Carry, and Apollo are pivoting toward retail distribution, specifically targeting the massive pools of money in US 401ks and European cash deposits.
Which sounds lovely until you realize that private credit is starting to look a lot more like opaque credit. Is there any actual transparency in this new era of retail-funded private lending?
That's the danger. There's a real concern that the illiquidity premium in these private markets might be an illusion created by the lack of a continuous pricing mechanism. Because these assets don't trade daily, they exhibit an artificial stability that makes a portfolio look much calmer and less correlated with public markets than it actually is.
So it's the financial version of this stays at the same price until I say otherwise.
It's even more structural than that. As discussed in Capital Allocators, we're seeing what is called a Swiss cheese phenomenon in global private credit. Lenders, unable to compete on price or terms due to regulatory pressures like Basel III and IV, are beginning to erode fundamental legal rights and structural covenants. This creates a feedback loop where they end up concentrating risk in high valuation sectors, like software, just to compensate for the loss of those legal protections.
We are essentially building a global financial system out of increasingly thin slices of cheese.
It's a massive redistribution of risk. We see this in the shift toward asset-based finance, where firms are moving capital from traditional bank balance sheets into more specialized, non-sponsor-backed lending. While this fills a gap left by U.S. regional banks facing regulatory pressure, it also moves much of the world's credit risk away from the highly regulated banking sector and into much less visible corners of the economy.
Investors in energy and commodities need to watch the Fed's next move on the balance sheet very closely.
Definitely. We have to watch if the Fed initiates a new round of balance sheet reductions in 2027, which would drastically change the liquidity landscape for all asset classes.
Watch the 10-year Treasury yield stability.
And keep an eye on any sudden shifts in Japanese bond buying patterns, because that could trigger the liquidity crunch that breaks the whole debt servicing cycle.
But all of this macro instability is really just the backdrop for the much more immediate physical bottlenecks currently squeezing the global oil supply. Every time we look at the global energy map, it feels like we're just tracking a series of increasingly expensive ways to get stuck. We've got a massive tension between the illusion of abundance from strategic reserves and the very real reality of physical bottlenecks. So looking at choke points and crude volatility, Alex, are we looking at a temporary spike or a permanent structural breakdown?
It's looking more structural. We aren't just facing a supply deficit in crude, we are facing a massive shortage of refined products. While crude oil is physically present, the loss of roughly 3 million barrels per day in refining capacity, largely due to the strikes on Russian refineries, has created an unbridgeable gap in the middle distillates market.
So the oil is there, but we just can't turn it into anything useful.
Stepping back on Bloomberg surveillance, analysts noted that the energy crisis is better understood through crack spreads than crude prices. When you see a $70 spread between oil and products, it's a signal that we've moved from a simple supply deficit to a severe structural shortage of things like diesel and jet fuel.
And speaking of things we can't move, the Strait of Hormuz has basically become a parking lot. The U.S. naval blockade reinstated on July 14th has almost entirely halted shipping through the strait.
It's more than just a military blockade, though. Macro voices argued that the recent closure of the Strait of Hormuz was actually achieved through regulatory warfare. Specifically, EU solvency laws were used to force insurance companies to cancel policies within a 7-day window following a U.S. naval strike near Cyrilla. It wasn't just about sinking ships, it was about making the ships uninsurable.
Instead of a Hollywood-style naval battle, we're just using fine print insurance clauses to paralyze global trade. That is peak 2026.
It's highly effective. And that instability is bleeding into the petrochemical sector, too. According to Leonardo Sequeira, these disruptions in the Hormuz Strait created an immediate supply shock for naphtha. We've seen C5 resin prices skyrocket from $1,330 per ton in February to over $2,300 in April, because the fundamental inputs just aren't arriving.
It's a domino effect. You block a strait, diesel prices jump, and suddenly the cost of adhesives for everything from cars to packaging goes up. But what about the other side of the Middle East? Is the Bab al-Mandeb the new frontline?
The focus is shifting there. While the Strait of Hormuz is the high-profile wound, the real threat to the Bab al-Mandeb isn't just a Houthi physical blockade. Macro voices pointed out that the real danger is European insurers canceling war coverage for vessels carrying Russian and Saudi oil. If that happens, the transit of 6 million barrels of oil daily is effectively paralyzed.
And I assume the middle distillate squeeze is getting even tighter.
It's a perfect storm. We have a situation where jet fuel is now competing directly with diesel for limited refinery output. This is being exacerbated by Russia's diesel export ban from mid-June. When you combine that with the U.S.-Iran conflict, the aviation industry is facing extreme volatility in both jet fuel and SAF prices.
It's also worth noting that China isn't just sitting there watching their energy inputs get held hostage.
Not at all. China's massive investments in solar, wind, and nuclear are strategic hedges designed to mitigate the risk of a Malacca Strait blockade. They've been preparing for maritime blockades since at least 2019.
It's a massive game of geopolitical chess where the pieces are all flammable.
And the stakes are rising. Even the sulfur market is reeling, with over 1 million tons of shipments stuck in the Strait of Hormuz earlier this year. It's a transition from a volume-based issue to a structural cost-based issue that will likely keep risk premiums elevated for the foreseeable future.
Refiners in Europe need to start hedging for a much higher floor on diesel deliveries.
The big signal to watch is whether European insurance premiums stabilize, or if we see another wave of policy cancellations following any new naval strikes.
But if we can't even move the oil we have, how are we going to manage the looming crisis in the natural gas and LNG markets? I thought we'd moved past the era of global supply chains and into the era of global supply chaos. Is it just me, or does the 2026 LNG market look like a game of musical chairs where someone just broke all the legs off the chairs?
It's more of a supply squeeze than a game, Maya. The Middle East conflict has effectively neutralized the 2026 global LNG supply surplus, slashing projected year-on-year growth from 11% down to just 1%, as losses from Qatar and the UAE offset gains from US and Canadian projects.
So the surplus we were all celebrating was essentially a mirage.
And the mechanics of how buyers are reacting are fascinating. Commodities Focus noted that India and Bangladesh procurement strategies have shifted toward extreme short-termism, moving from tenders for 25, 30 days forward to less than 15, 20 days, allowing buyers to capture discounts by forcing sellers to choose between floating cargoes or accepting low prices.
Ah, the take-it-or-leave-it strategy. Very sophisticated. I assume that's why we're seeing China and South Korea basically running for the coal exits.
China's imports are down 8% and South Korea's are down 10% as they pivot to coal to mitigate gas reliance. It's a massive shift in energy security. Even the JKM West India marker spread collapsed, creating a temporary price parity that allowed cargoes to surge from west to east.
But even if we find the gas, can we actually move it? Because the math on US cargoes headed to Europe looks expensive.
It's non-viable right now. The Platts East-West arbitrage is assessed at negative $1 per MMBTU for vessels transiting the Cape of Good Hope. Plus, there's a massive structural bottleneck. Those damaged Qatar Energy LNG trains will likely take 3 to 4 years to repair.
European regulators are going to have a very long autumn.
If EU gas storage levels fail to approach the 90% target by November, we could see renewed financial guarantees for storage, similar to Germany's 2022 strategy.
European energy ministers need to finalize those storage subsidies before the frost hits. Keep an eye on the November storage mandates because that's the trigger for a global price surge. But as we look at these fossil fuel pivots, how much of this is actually about the climate and how much is just about avoiding a blackout?
I've been digging into the EU's shifting carbon market strategy, and the move from passive rights to a performance-based model is going to rewrite the playbook for heavy industry.
You mean they're finally adding some teeth to the regulations? Or is this just another way to make paperwork more expensive?
It's more structural than that. As CTVC by Citeline Climate notes, the EU ETS reform transforms free allowances from a passive right into a mechanism where companies must submit verified decarbonization plans just to access 80% of their permits.
So it's no longer a free pass, it's a show us your homework or lose your discount policy.
They are pairing this with a new Euro's 100 billion industrial decarbonization bank, using a two-stage approach with a 30 billion investment booster followed by 70 billion in carbon contracts for difference to target revenue risk.
It sounds like a massive government-subsidized incentive program wrapped in a compliance cloak. It's like a gym membership where the trainer promises you'll lose weight, but only if you prove you've actually been lifting the weights.
The trade-off is the timeline. The proposed changes include a slower annual reduction rate of 3.7% through 2035 and extending free allowances to 2038. This creates a strategic delay that will likely push final investment decisions for green and blue ammonia projects further into the future.
Meanwhile, the market is looking for new ways to play.
Right, the inclusion of bio-CCS and DACCS into the ETS provides a vital demand signal for carbon removal developers. We're also seeing a fundamental structural pivot in pyrogenic biocarbon. Chris Weiberg noted at the recent ISO meeting that the sector is moving from a secondary biofuel additive to a primary product category.
Heavy industry investors need to start auditing those decarbonization plans before the 2038 deadline. Keep an eye on those first carbon contracts for difference auctions to see if they actually bridge the revenue gap. As we wrap up this edition, the throughline is clear. We are witnessing a collision between an era of boundless digital ambition and the hard physical limits of a strained planet. From the trillion-dollar surge in AI capital expenditure to the staggering 60% spike in PJM supply costs, the math of the digital revolution is being rewritten by the sheer scarcity of electrons and the eroding capacity of our refining and delivery infrastructure.
The implication runs deeper. The core implication here isn't just that energy is getting more expensive. It's that the fundamental calculus for heavy industry and utility operators has shifted from managing demand to managing systemic fragility. For the decision makers at companies like Micron or the major regional grid operators, the priority is no longer just scaling capacity, but hedging against a structural, supply-side inflationary environment that could be locked in by the very infrastructure needed to support the AI transition. We are moving from a period of navigating market volatility to one of navigating physical bottlenecks that are increasingly resistant to traditional monetary levers.
It leaves us in a position where the volatility in everything from C5 resins to global LNG forecasts isn't just noise, it's a symptom of a world struggling to power its own progress.
To see if this thesis holds, keep a close eye on the upcoming European gas storage levels as we approach the autumn season. If those thresholds fail to hit targets despite the EU's heavy decarbonization subsidies, it will confirm that we have entered a period where supply-side shocks are officially driving the global macro narrative, regardless of what central banks attempt to do with interest rates.
Thanks for joining us for this week's digest. We'll see you next Tuesday.